women often shoulder much of the responsibility for contraception, but a male pill could soon become a reality. My guest this morning is Professor Chris Barrett, who's head of the Reproductive Medicine Group at the University of Dundee in Scotland. He's dedicated his career to understanding male infertility, human spermatozoa and sperm-egg interaction. A male pill, of course, has been in development for decades, but a non-hormonal one has now entered human trials. Interested in your whakaaro and pātai, your thoughts and questions on this, 2101 to get in touch. Chris Barrett, kia ora, good morning, welcome to Saturday Morning.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
I'm well, thank you. Interested in the work that you do, though, and talk us through the situation with the male pill. Why is it, after all these decades, that we still don't have one on the market?
Well, that's probably a $64,000 question. I think there are a number of reasons I would suggest for that. One of them has been that, you know, the hormonal methods for male contraception have been on the horizon probably every 5 years for the last 40 years. So people have always thought that the hormonal contraceptive methods for men are close to fruition. So people have been put off a little bit in going down other avenues. I think that's issue A. Issue B is that our understanding of how sperm cells are produced and therefore how you may interrupt that function is relatively poor. So we haven't had lots of alternative ways of looking at this for some time. And if you think about, you know, men produce 1,000 sperm in every heartbeat. So, you know, that's a large number of sperm produced over a day. And you've got to stop all of those sperm. It's no good. It's no good leaving one or two still moving. So it is actually quite a difficult thing to do as well.
So the hormonal one perhaps is not so likely. The work that you do, though, has been more perhaps informed, has it, with infertility, because it's been about making healthy sperm less good at swimming.
Yes, and I think that's, I mean, I think that there's the hormonal methods for men. They're now in a clinical trial sponsored by the United States government. They have a patch that a man puts on his shoulder where that's showing real promise at the moment. It's a hormonal method. So I think probably there's more optimism now in the hormonal methods in doing that. But the approach that we've been using is basically related to can we recapitulate really male infertility, where the sperm cells are still produced, but they are non-functional. And about 1 in 20 men in the world have dysfunctional sperm cells. So it's trying to mimic that approach. That's the part that we've been trying to look at. And what we're particularly interested in is the movement of the cell, particularly in the female reproductive tract. So a sperm cell needs to move to go from point A to point B. And if we can affect that process, then in theory, we should be able to block fertilization and therefore act as a contraceptive.
Mm. Is it fair to say that it's more complex trying to come up with some sort of male contraceptive?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, it just for the simple fact that you've got to stop all of these sperm cells. And sperm cells are produced 24/7. I mean, they're just continual production of all these cells, and you've got to stop all of them. And I think that is a substantial challenge. So, for example, in the hormonal methods, the idea is to cut off the sperm production factory, basically, so that no cells are produced, or very, very few, and those cells are dysfunctional. But the challenge with that is that it takes often 10 or so weeks to be able to block that production. And then, of course, if you want the contraception to be reversible, you've got to then wait another 10 weeks for it to come back online, so to speak. So that's the challenge with the hormonal approach. The advantage of a non-hormonal approach would be you could interrupt the sperm cell function relatively quickly. And that's, of course, quite attractive, because in theory, you could have a reversible method that could be relatively quick. But of course, that's some way off at the moment. But it is, it's not easy biology. The biology is quite complex. And I think that's been a big challenge. And up until quite recently, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are funding a lot of work in this arena. But without their input, funding in this scientific space was quite low. So people weren't that interested in male contraception or how you interrupt sperm function in the female tract. So its funding has been relatively low historically. And now, of course, it's being geared up by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the United States government.
Why do you think that is, that it's not been so at the front of the queue for priority over the decades? Is it about science? Is it about sexism?
I think part of it's science because the science has been relatively, poor, I guess. Our knowledge has been relatively poor. I think the second thing, which is historically, people have often said, well, men wouldn't take a pill or women wouldn't trust men to take a pill, etc. And in the 1980s and the early 1990s, there was some data to suggest that. But over the last 30 years, we've seen a transformation in attitudes to reproductive medicine and by couples. And now all the recent research shows that couples would be very willing to test a male contraceptive and or use a contraceptive that attacks the sperm in the female tract. So I think historically we had a sort of a rather what I would say, stuck in the Roman age idea about reproduction, and that's not the case now. So I think there's several reasons why I think we're more optimistic about getting research done at this moment in time than we have been historically.
Yeah, the issue of trust is definitely a significant one. Would you trust someone who said, "Oh no, I'm on the pill, don't worry"? Is there also another sort of societal aspect to this, that some men may find that if their sperm wasn't able to swim as well, would they see that as a threat to their masculinity?
I mean I think again that's I think quite an old old in this history the relationship between male fertility and virility as an example. So if you're thinking of methods for contraception, they would be reversible. So otherwise there's not really point for having a new contraceptive method. So if the sperm cells weren't working for some period of time, then obviously you can stop taking the drug or change the approach, and then the sperm cell would be working again. So from that point of view, it would be a temporary interruption of function, and it would be done obviously because the couple felt that that was a method that they would like to try. So some men may feel that, but I think in the couples that we've talked to, it's pretty rare that people feel that these days. But of course, if they do that, then of course it would not be for them.
How would you go about trialing something like this? Because I guess it's pretty high stakes if it turns out not
It's
to
very,
work.
very high stakes. Yeah, it's very high stakes. So I think the absolute key factor is safety, because usually when you're developing drugs or compounds for diseases, these diseases have various different manifestations, and some are very very bad for people and result in death. So if you're developing drugs for terminal diseases, you've got quite a threshold where you can have some toxicity of the compound. But in this case, these people are normal. There's nothing, they're completely healthy couples. So therefore your safety bar for a drug is very, very high. And that makes developing a compound to affect the sperm function very difficult, because it's quite easy to stop sperm swimming, but those compounds are toxic to other cells of the body. And of course, that's not acceptable. So your safety bar is very, very high. And that, I think, will make developing non-hormonal methods, it's going to be more challenging than it would be for other diseases, for example.
I guess also, if if you get it wrong, if it turns out that the drug doesn't work, then more people could show up as a result. More babies could be born because the drug didn't work.
Absolutely, absolutely. But there are very few contraceptive methods at the moment that are 100% effective. in the real world, for example. So condoms, for example, their real world efficacy, their real world world usefulness is after 12 months, about 14% of couples will become pregnant, for example. So current methods in general, there is some failure rate, although it's very, very small. So you'd be looking for the same type of failure rate, but you'd need to be about 99% effective for sure.
Contraception delivery methods have really changed over the last few decades as well. I mean, when we talk about the female pill, it was always an actual pill that people had to swallow, whereas, of course, now there are different ways of that getting into the body. What sort of delivery method do you anticipate for a male contraceptive? Would it be a pill or would it be something
Yeah.
like a patch?
Well, the patches at the moment are the gels, for example, for the hormonal methods, where a gel is rubbed onto the shoulder of the man. They seem to be very well tolerated by couples, very well tolerated by the man, and they seem to be pretty effective in reducing sperm counts, etc. If you were thinking of a pill that a man could take, then you could have that pill for example, it could be a pill that's taken quite quickly before the sexual intercourse, for example, maybe a few hours to block sperm motility or sperm function, and then that effect may wear off after a few hours. So that might be one approach, although that's quite difficult to do, but that might be one approach. Another approach could be to have longer term contraceptives, so there may be even a patch or a transdermal implant, for example, that could last several months, as an example. So there are different ways, and I think we always talk about the male pill as if it's a one if it's a one method that we would use. I think, quite frankly, we need more than one new method for the male and to interrupt sperm function in the female tract. So I think there's going to be and different ways of approaching this, and couples may want different approaches. They may not all want a long-term effect. Some may want a short-term effect. So I think we always talk about the male pill as if it's a one thing, but I like to think of it as a, more than one option coming forward rather than just one.
Professor Chris Barrett's my guest on Saturday morning with Susie Ferguson, head of the Reproductive Medicine Group at the University of Dundee. Just before we move off this topic, Chris, what sort of time frame, if you dare to put one on this? How long would it
Well,
be before we, before we get a male contraceptive on the market?
I think if you talk to the people with working on the patch, as an example, the hormonal methods, they're very, I think my understanding is they'll get some very encouraging results at the end of this year, which will be released. So then they need to do another trial, a phase three trial, it would be called, and that could take several years. So I think optimistically, we'd be looking at a male or contraceptive based on a hormonal approach. We could be looking at 5 to 7 years where it's being tested on the market, for example. When it comes to non-hormonal methods, then there are some very small clinical trials for safety at the moment on one or two compounds, but we're talking at a much longer time frame, I think. We're talking at least 10 years before we cross that barrier, I would suggest, because of the safety issues, as an example, and because of the challenges of the biology.
If we look more generally at the question of fertility or indeed infertility, is it becoming clear why sperm counts are dropping in the way that they are?
Yes, I mean that's a very interesting question. I think the evidence at this moment in time suggests that sperm counts are declining. I think if you look at it holistically and throughout the world, and they're dropping, the evidence suggests they're dropping quite significantly. So that's been debated for some time. It's been debated for the last 20 years, but I think now we understand that, it's probably the data is pretty good. The question of why that is we don't know, is the answer to that. The very blunt answer is we don't know. But it's likely to be a combination of lifestyle, environment, etc. it's unlikely to just be one thing because it appears to be relevant in a number of different regions. So it's not just a local environment effect, for example. So I think we do understand that the incidence of male infertility is increasing, and that is a cause for concern, of course. But why that is, I would suggest the data is we don't really know. We can speculate, but we don't actually know.
I found it interesting reading up ahead of talking to you this morning, and it seemed to be reasonably widespread. I don't know if common's the right word, that if a couple end up in a fertility clinic, very much the woman is the one that is looked at to see what is going on. And often the man is sort of not quite seen as incidental, but perhaps is less scrutinized when it comes to their sperm and sort of what they're bringing to all of this. Is that right? Is that the case that it should be looked at in that particular way?
I think your observation is absolutely correct. I mean, that is the real situation that happens on in almost all patients who attend infertility clinics. That is wrong, but that's actually what does happen. The male should be investigated thoroughly for a physical examination and a history and a detailed assessment of his sperm undertaken. But that is not always the case, to be sure. I think the more we understand about the contribution of the male, the more that we're now starting to look at the male. And since, in the last 10 years, I think our interest has grown quite substantially, but it is still way, way behind our understanding of the female contribution to infertility. So basically, I think your observation is correct, unfortunately, but it shouldn't be that way. And hopefully in the future, it won't be that way.
And men do have a biological clock. There are consequences of being an older father too, in regards to the sperm quality.
Yes, and this is generally poorly understood, I think, by couples. Even when you're talking to them, there's an understanding of the effect of the female factor and age. Most people understand that. They can't draw a very accurate curve, but they understand that. But they don't understand the male part. They see on the television on for example of an older father, 70 or 80. As father to child, and therefore the observation is, oh, everything's fine, sperm counts stay the same, fertility stays the same. And that's absolutely wrong. That's completely not correct. It doesn't mean to say it, a 90-year-old may father a child, but the chances of that are really very low. And I'll give you an example. In a study that was done about 20 years ago in Bristol, they looked at 8,000 couples. And what they showed there was that if everything else was equal, female age, etc., the chances of achieving a live birth if a man was 40 compared to if the man was 25 was 50% less. So male infertility increases significantly with age, even over a relatively short period of time. And that is poorly understood amongst couples. And in fact, it's poorly understood sometimes amongst professionals. But it's definitely, there is a biological clock in men, absolutely.
A fascinating territory. Just one quick question, actually, Chris, before I let you go. Greg has been in touch this morning on 2101 saying, would there be greater safety issues for men taking the male contraceptive pill and Viagra at the same time? It's an interesting area where you've got different interplay between medication.
Well, that's we obviously we don't know that. That would need to be tested. Using a Viagra, for example, it's a relatively safe drug to be used. There are relatively minor heart very minor issues with that, but there are still issues with that. There are contraindications to using Viagra, for example, if there's been a heart problem in the past. So you would need that would need to be looked at for sure. And that just illustrates the challenge of looking at safety for contraception because it needs to be absolute, for example.
Thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate you talking to us this morning.
Pleasure.
On Saturday Pleasure. Morning. That is Chris Barrett, Professor Chris Barrett there from the University of Dundee over in Scotland.